T-minus 15 seconds. Guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9. Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11. Tower cleared.
We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win.
Okay, engine stop. CPA at a descent. Hose control, both autos, engine command override off. Engine arm off. 413 is in.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
My guest on Cosmic Perspective Radio attended the University of Connecticut, where he received his bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering. He also received a PhD in plasma physics from MIT, is a veteran of 7 space shuttle missions, and is co-founder and CEO of Ad Astra Rocket Company, a company that will develop a rocket engine that will take humans to Mars in a fraction of a time with using conventional technology. Dr. Franklin Chang Diaz, thanks for joining us today on Cosmic Perspective Radio.
My pleasure. It's a pleasure to be here.
You were born in Costa Rica, and I understand that at a very young age you had thoughts of being an astronaut. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm a product of the space age. 1950 was when I was born, halfway through the century. And the first launching of Sputnik, Sputnik 1, was 1957. I was 7 years old. And, you know, I was not the only one, but it was a bug that was caught by a lot of young children at the time, the space bug, to really look at the sky as a place where people could go and explore. And as children, we used to play. There were no astronauts in those days, but we did play as pretend space explorers. And I remember I used to have my own spaceship, which was basically a cardboard box, a refrigerator-size cardboard box where I would get in there with my friends and cousins, and we would play being in a spaceship and moving on to exploring distant planets and coming back in time for dinner. So it was essentially a make-believe. It was the imagination was the only limit. And as time passed, and of course space became a reality, first astronauts were selected in the late 50s and like 59, and the first human flew in space in 61, and the second one, and then there were others. And these people became real for us, and this crystallized in me the calling, the wish to be one of them and to make my career in space. And that's what I did. That's why I left Costa Rica when I was 18 and came to the United States in pursuit of that dream.
You actually came to Connecticut and attended Harford
High. That's right. In fact, it was our 50th reunion just this year. I had already graduated in Costa Rica from high school, but that was in 67. But when I came to the U.S., I didn't speak English. I did not, you know, have any money or anything to move on to college. And so I almost had to go backwards. I went back to high school, and that was Harford High. I went to Harford High in 68-69, and the purpose was to learn English, but also to graduate from a U.S. High school, which would give me at least a potential ticket to go to the university. And I did both. So I enrolled in Harford High, and I was able to do well enough to graduate in the following spring. So in 69, I landed a scholarship from the state of Connecticut to attend the University of Connecticut. It was a tremendous break for me, and certainly the same year that Neil Armstrong landed on the moon. So it was kind of an interesting convergence of things at a moment in time that made me feel a little bit closer to my goals.
And then you eventually went to MIT and received your PhD. So you must have got your master's degree in between.
No, I did not get a master's. I went straight for the PhD. I was in a hurry to try to finish. I had also to deal with the realities of having to feed myself. And I had already gotten married and I had a child. And so I had to worry about bringing enough sustenance to the home. So I was in a hurry to get out of being a student. But there was an interesting thing that happened in 69 and 70 and 71 that the space program, which was nearly 5% of the federal budget, was cut, significantly cut. And so in the late 60s, early 70s, there were thousands of aerospace engineers who had been laid off and out of work. And in fact, many of my professors told me that I should not pursue a career in space because I would not get a job because the space program had been cut significantly. And at the time, also, there was an energy crisis that sprung up due to the curtailing of production of oil from the oil-producing countries, OPEC. In 1973, there were lines of people in all gas stations trying to get gasoline. There was no fuel.
I was one of them.
you remember that. So.
Yes.
And it was pretty bad in places, you know, like Connecticut and the Northeast. When it gets cold in the winter, there was no heating oil. So there was some real problems. So an energy crisis prompted the government to really start funding programs in alternative energies. And one of those was nuclear fusion. Thermonuclear fusion, which was fascinating to me and something that I thought ultimately would power spaceships in the future. So it kind of made me follow a little detour in my quest for space in going into energy. So I studied nuclear energy, nuclear engineering. I went to MIT directly to the field of plasma physics and fusion technology. And the space program almost went dormant for several years until the late 70s when the space shuttle began to do the early approach and landing tests, first atmospheric flights. It hadn't flown in space yet, but you could see it on TV, and it just really rekindled the whole dream of space. And I had become a U.S. citizen by then. It was 1977. I applied twice to the astronaut program. On the first try, I was rejected, which is fairly, I guess, expected. And second time around, though, I get through the selection process and ultimately was selected on that second class of astronauts, 1980. And that was a dream come true, at least in getting into the program. It was not until 6 years later that I actually did my first flight.
That's pretty amazing, the going from a box in a
cardboard box
as a child.
I often talk about that on that day when I was trapped on the space shuttle Columbia, getting ready to fly into space for real, and I was just sitting there laying back on my back just like I did on my cardboard box. And I thought to myself, you know, I've done this before. And it was kind of like, you know, going back in time to those early years. But this time it was for real.
An amazing experience to get that feeling, to be in space and have that feeling from back to the time you were a kid and you're finally there.
Yeah, sure was.
I'd like to talk a little bit about some of your space shuttle missions.
Okay.
You know, when people watch EVAs, particularly me or anyone, these EVAs look basically flawless, but astronauts and NASA make them look as if they are.
Well, it's deceiving, and it is probably not a good thing to make them look like they're so simple, because they're not. Behind every minute and every hour of spacewalks. There are dozens, maybe hundreds of hours, in my case, for over many years, of hours in practice, practicing underwater, practicing in different types of conditions and chambers, and honing those skills and orchestrating the whole process of what you're going to do outside. And that is needed because it is very unforgiving, the environment, and also very expensive, of course. And you want to eliminate as much as you can the possibility of failure, the possibility of mistakes and human errors. They have happened, though. People have lost components. They've lost pieces of hardware. And you have to realize that when you're out there, you're not really standing still. You're moving at hyper velocity, 17,000 miles an hour. And any piece of hardware that you let go becomes a projectile that could ultimately hit somebody else or something else, a satellite or an orbiting spacecraft of some sort, causing a great deal of damage. So it's very important to get the EVA, to get it right, to do it carefully.
Certainly traveling faster than a bullet.
Definitely so. Yeah.
I understand that on your very first spacewalk, you had some difficulties, and that you were on the dark side, or I should say the night side of the Earth, facing away. And you had quite an experience. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
It was an interesting experience of solitude, I guess, in my case. There was nothing really life-threatening or anything like that that I could tell. It was just the confluence of a number of factors. I was standing on the end of the robotic arm, the Canadian robotic arm of the space station. They were transporting me, operated by other astronauts inside the station. They were transporting me from one end of the station to another. And it just is a way to get places a little quicker than having to go hand over hand. So what happened is right at the middle of the arc, the arm broke. Basically, the motors froze up and the whole thing stopped. And I was there sort of in the middle of nowhere. And of course, there was no motion. And the astronauts inside the station told me that, you know, they were having some kind of a glitch with the arm. And turns out that it was a software glitch, as I understand, and they had to reboot the computer software to make the arm come back to life, and it did. But there was a time, maybe about 15, 20 minutes or so, when there was a great deal of silence, and of course they were all probably debating what they were going to do, and I was just oblivious to the whole thing, because the transmission was not between me and the rest, but it was between the ground controllers and those on the spaceship that were operating the arm. So I was not listening to those transmissions. Anyway, so I had about 20 minutes of contemplation, I guess you can think of it like that. It's essentially look around and where am I? You know, I'm here in the middle of space. And it so happened that we went in over the dark side of the Earth, and flying over the ocean, there was very little light. I couldn't really see the Earth very much, and the space station and the rest of the hardware was behind me, so I couldn't see that either. And so the thing that happens is what I could see out my visor through my helmet was just space, stars everywhere. And it gave me a feeling of, it was a little eerie and a little overcoming with sort of had an emotional tinge to it. It just makes you think about solitude and makes you think about being all by yourself in a place where there was nobody else. It's one of those things that happens very quickly. You get these thoughts and feelings. But as an astronaut, we learn to control these emotions quickly and focus our attention on what we need to do and what needs to be done and the procedures that are soon to come. And that took away my mind from those sensations. But it was a kind of nice thing that I will remember forever.
And I understand that there is an aurora you were treated to shortly after.
Absolutely, absolutely. That was another interesting sort of moment that when we went through sort of the dark pass, it was also the aurora. It was the south, so the Aurora Australis in the southern hemisphere. It was very, very beautiful. It was extraordinarily beautiful. And we flew right through it. Being a plasma physicist, it was kind of interesting to be flying through a plasma myself, which is what the Aurora is.
I can't fathom seeing the darkness of space and all the stars without basically any sunlight. And then the Aurora, what an incredible experience.
It was a tremendous experience. I still remember it.
And of course, you had some other experiences on STS-34, I believe. IMAX had paid millions of dollars to film Destiny in Space.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You were trained to use the camera and to make the movie, and you had some technical problems, which I understand you needed astronaut Shannon Lucid's sock to fix the problem.
That's right. We had had a failure on the way up towards space in the shuttle's cooling system. And kind of long story short, the cabin became very, very hot and very humid. And the lenses, which we use for the IMAX camera, are very big lenses. It was almost the size of a blender. And the IMAX movie camera itself is a big contraption of motors, electric motors, which have a lot of power. And the film is very heavy. So, you know, it's a very bulky, heavy piece of equipment, which has to be securely anchored to the window to take the shot. And I did all that in preparation for shooting the deployment of Galileo, which was a very spectacular thing to capture on film. And I had trained many, many hours at great expense by the IMAX people to capture that shot. It was only a few seconds. And I got it all set up, but when I looked through the viewfinder just a few seconds before Galileo deployment, I couldn't see anything. Turns out that the lens was completely fogged up with the humidity and the temperature of the cabin. And in desperation, just a few seconds before I was supposed to pull the trigger, I just happened to see Shannon Lucid's foot with a nice sock, which I removed and then wiped off the lens, which was a real no-no in the training. We weren't supposed to wipe those lenses with just any rag. We had to use very special cleaning agents, but, you know, there was no time. And so I did, and I took the shot free-floating, which is another no-no. And I spent the rest of the mission worried about that I had messed up that shot. But it turned out okay in the end. It took maybe a second or two, but the shot came out beautifully. And I found that out later when we saw the film on the ground. If you watch that movie, Destiny in Space, and you see that Galileo deployment, you'll notice a little sort of oscillation in the camera in the very first couple of seconds of the take. And that's me trying to stabilize myself and preventing from getting spun up by the motors of the camera.
I have to say that I did see the movie. I didn't notice any differences. And I have to go back and take a look now.
You have to go back, and I'm glad you didn't notice anything.
It must have been quite a long time to wait till the film got developed to know whether everything came out.
Oh, it was agonizing. It was agonizing. You know, I pretty much spent the whole flight pretty depressed that I had really messed up that one thing that I had been trained for amongst the other things that I had to do. But this was a very important one. And the IMAX company probably spent a great deal of money and time training me to do this. And so I was very upset. But it turned out really well. And so, you know, I'm glad you didn't notice anything. But now if you look at it again, and right at the very beginning, you'll see a little wiggle on the camera. And now you'll know. Most people see this site as a beautiful, peaceful, extremely majestic. And they have no idea of the pandemonium that was going on behind the camera with people trying to stabilize themselves and a lot of yelling and screaming to make sure that we got everything done right.
As I said, astronauts make things look flawless, and it was certainly not a flawless experience.
No, it was very full of flaws.
I understand that you participated in a NASA mission on the ground, a mission of diplomacy. You were chosen to accompany a diplomat to talk to the Chilean dictator, Pinochet, regarding a landing strip for NASA.
Yeah, that was, you know, in the early days when we were trying to set up the landing, emergency landing site in the Pacific, because in the early days of the space shuttle program, we were going to have two launch sites, one at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, but another one in California. And the launches in California were going to fly essentially due south over the Pacific Ocean, and there was no place to land in case there was a malfunction. We did have those landing sites available in the eastern launches, some in Africa, some in southern Europe, but there were none in the Pacific except for Easter Island, which had a landing site. It had to be expanded. The runway was too short. And there was a lot of negotiation going on with the Chilean government to be able to get that done. And I was part of that. There were others who came and others after me as well. But there was a time when I had to go and talk to there was the president himself. And there was a lot of tension between the U.S. and Chile at the time. And I guess having the ability to speak Spanish and, you know, my upbringing in Costa Rica and the knowledge about Costa Rica as a peaceful country, I think that really broke the ice and made it very much easier for the discussions to proceed. So another one for the history.
So you were able to, NASA was able to have the landing strip they needed. So,
yeah, they were able to secure that landing strip and the rights to land there. And, of course, they had to spend quite a bit of money to expand the landing site.
I'd like to ask you one more question about being an astronaut before we move on to other exciting things. You were an astronaut for more than a decade, 1986 to 2002, I think, if that's correct.
Mm-hmm.
Did you notice any social changes from your first flight to your last within NASA?
Well, yeah, there was a great deal of change because following my first flight, about 10 days after we came back from that first flight, we had the Challenger explosion. And that accident pretty much transformed, you know, NASA in many ways. And it also transformed the way astronauts operated space flight. There was a lot of soul-searching that occurred as a result of that accident. We changed our procedures. We changed including who could fly. We had a very open program with people who were called spaceflight participants, one of whom was Krista McAuliffe, the first teacher in space. And there were others who were going to be coming down the whole program. And that program for spaceflight participants changed. And it became a lot more structured, a lot more rigid, and a lot of the behavior towards what we had to do changed. A lot more discipline, and the management, the culture changed, at least long enough for me to remember all those processes that we had to go through to make sure that we could survive, at least attempt to survive the potential similar catastrophes. And we even changed our clothing. You may remember from the early flights, we all flew with just regular flight suits and just a simple face pressure helmet. And after the Challenger, then we had to wear full pressure suits. So, yeah, there was a lot of culture changes. NASA Johnson Space Center closed its doors to visitors, and that's when they built the Space Center Houston, which is sort of adjacent to NASA, but was able to now handle the visitors that used to come directly to the Space Center. We didn't have a visitor center at the time. It was just a small museum. So all of those things changed.
Yeah. Well, my wife and I went on our honeymoon, and we went to Kennedy Space Center, and we walked right into the VAB next to the Saturn V rockets. You know, that's how things were.
Yeah, that all changed.
Next, I'd like to talk about something that I think is very exciting, The Variable Specific Impulse Magnetoplasma Rocket.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yes. That's very exciting.
A very versatile rocket that you're developing that will revolutionize deep space travel and also take humans to Mars in a fraction of the time, something like 39 or 40 days than we do today. It may be best to tell our listeners a little bit how long it would take to get to Mars with just conventional technology.
Yeah, conventional rockets will get a mission to Mars. Fastest, perhaps, is about 7 months. Typically, is maybe 8 or 9, depending on the size of the payload that you're delivering. If it's something really big and heavy, it will take a little longer. If it's lighter, then it will be faster. But these kinds of propulsion systems, they haven't changed very much from the days of the early rockets. Basically, they're controlled explosions is what they are. Oftentimes, we describe that traveling in space is like traveling on a cannonball. You fire a cannon, and then you get propelled by the explosion. But most of the time, you are coasting. Most of the time, you're not accelerating, you're just coasting. And if you want to stop, you have to fire another cannon to stop. And if you want to come back, then you have to fire another cannon to come back. And when you arrive, you have to fire another one to stop. So this is impulsive maneuvers, as we call them. And this is all due to the fact that we are constrained by chemical rockets, chemical reactions. So what we're trying to change is that whole approach to move to plasma propulsion, electric propulsion. The problem is that you need electricity, as you can imagine. And of course, the electricity then is used to heat a propellant. We don't call it a fuel anymore because there's no combustion, there's no chemistry. We call it a propellant, and the propellant is heated with electricity. So that's why it's called electric propulsion. And the propellant becomes a plasma, which because it is so hot, it can be guided and controlled by electric and magnetic fields rather than the contours of a physical rocket. And because it is controlled by electric and magnetic fields, then it can be made to not touch any of the surrounding materials of the ship or the rocket. And as a result, you can make it as hot as you want. And the plasma that we deal with in our Vasimir engine, our propulsion system, is up to 5 million degrees. And wow. That is a lot hotter than the typical exhaust of a chemical rocket, which is only a few thousand degrees. And the rockets, the hotter they get, the better they are.
So for every reaction, an equal opposite reaction.
That's right. You're getting material which is escaping at a much higher velocity, and therefore you get better impulse. So rockets, the hotter the exhaust, the better the rocket. The problem is that you need electricity, as I was mentioning earlier, and the electricity in space is hard to come. And this is one of the things that has prevented electric propulsion from being as powerful as a chemical rocket. Because, you know, electricity in space, in essence, mostly comes from the sun. So we have to have solar panels to be able to generate sufficient electricity. And over the years, we've never really had solar panels that had enough oomph to be able to power rockets to the same scale as the chemical rockets until now. And so now there are solar technologies that have been developed that are beginning to give us power levels which are very interesting, like now hundreds of kilowatts. And when you deal with power levels of hundreds of kilowatts, then you're talking about engines that are maybe as powerful as the engine of your car. A typical automobile is about a couple hundred kilowatts. A medium-sized SUV is about 200 kilowatts. So you see, now you're talking that you have enough electricity to start looking at an engine that can really process all of that power. And there was no engine that could do that. And that's what we're now building. It's an engine that can process large amounts of electricity. And of course, to go to Mars, you wouldn't use solar power. Because even the solar power, 100 kilowatts, is not enough. You would need megawatts. So the power of a nuclear submarine, for example. And when you develop those kinds of nuclear reactors that can give you that much electric power, then you can achieve those missions to Mars, which could be as fast as a couple of months, maybe a month, you know, significantly less than the time it takes today with chemical rockets. But it's important to know that you need not just the electricity and the electric power generator and a nuclear reactor. You need the engine that can process that much power. And that's what we're building.
And that makes sense because as you get further away from the sun, particularly with the inverse square law, you're going to lose a lot of the light from the sun for the solar panels. So I can see how a reactor would be a very important thing.
Yeah, it's absolutely essential. Nuclear electric power is essential for humans to really truly explore space because, you know, you may go to Mars, maybe the sun is still able to illuminate some level of solar power. But when you go to Jupiter, Saturn, beyond, the sun becomes a dimmer and dimmer and dimmer star, and it's just not really a practical source of energy. So nuclear power is a fundamental ingredient for a robust human exploration.
And I would actually think that that would give us the opportunity for sustainability. The NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine discusses going back to the moon to stay with sustainability and then to Mars. But I would think that we would need an engine like Vassimer to go back to Mars and stay for us to have sustainability.
Yes. The way we're developing Vassimer in our company is we first are interested in the solar application because we're going to be operating near the Earth and near the moon. And we're going to be doing commercial, essentially logistics services of transporting goods and supplies and equipment and stuff that sustainably can maintain a presence on the surface of the moon. You do need that capability. It's essentially a trucking business. That's what we are going to be providing using the Vassimer engine in the solar version of the Vassimer engine at a couple hundred kilowatts in power. These are just basically going to be trucks that enable you to transport lots of stuff a lot cheaper than you can do with chemical propulsion. And then that'll give you sustainability on the moon. And for us, it's extremely important to be able to have sustainability on the moon because that is where you will test multi-megawatt engines, engines that can now run at a megawatt or 10 megawatts. Not kilowatts, but megawatts. Those engines cannot be tested in our laboratory here on the Earth. They cannot be tested on the space station or spacecraft. You need to test them on the surface of the moon. And that is strategically very important to us because it enables the company to be able to test its products in an environment which would be second to none. So that's what we're doing.
That would kind of make sense to go back to the moon first and then to Mars, wouldn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. And that's the way we've always believed that that is the sensible way to approach human exploration needs to be done. Building the scaffolding that allows you to enable a capability and keep it in place so that you don't have to dismantle the entire scaffolding every time you go, which is what we did in the Apollo days. Essentially, we build the scaffolding in every single mission.
Instead of being redundant, a much cheaper way of space travel.
Exactly. And that's what sustainability is all about. So our company has this business plan, which involves first deploying the Vassimer more in the hundreds of kilowatts just to sustain cargo services to the moon. And then later we would do the multi-megawatt engines for sending humans to Mars. That would come later.
I'd like to ask one more question. I know we're getting a little short on time. I know you have a busy schedule. Has the development of the Vassimer engine been as rewarding or more rewarding than the seven space shuttle missions that you participated in?
You know, I think of it really as a continuum. I never really gave up space. I've been doing space probably since I was seven, and I'm still sort of playing in the same playpen. Just in a way, I've never grew up. I guess maybe I can think of it like that. And I'm just now working on something that I believe is very important for others coming after me, younger people who will have to deal with the long-duration missions to the outer planets, and we have to have a robust transportation infrastructure to enable them to do so. And I'm hoping to leave, maybe as a legacy, to continue to build on what others have done and help us move out into space.
Well, I think it's an incredible example of following your dream from the time you were in a cardboard box as an astronaut and continuing. I think it's a great message. I think you're saying to everyone, keep following your dreams.
Absolutely. Yeah, never stop. Never stop. Just keep dreaming.
Dr. Chang Diaz, thanks so much for joining us today on Cosmic Perspective Radio, and thanks for this very wonderful interview.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Good luck to you.
Where can our listeners learn more about Vasimer?
Well, we have quite a bit of information in our company. Just visit our website at astrorocket.com or just look on the internet. We're all over.
Dr. Chang Diaz, thanks again for joining us on Cosmic Perspective Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Cosmic Perspective Radio is an Andy Poneros production.